Miss Mel C.
I'm Milton. I'm an alcoholic. Before I get lost in my tale of woe, I'd like to thank Charlie for asking me to speak at this meeting. I consider Charlie a good friend and one of the finest examples of Alcoholics Anonymous that I know. And I don't know anybody out there understands what a great honor it is for me to speak at this meeting. It's kind of overwhelming. Now that I've sucked up, I just wrote some dates out for people who like to figure things out. I was born here in Southern California in 35. Had my first blackout drunk in Tijuana, Mexico in 1950. Called for directions for an AA meeting in 1957. Went to that meeting in 1966. I got sober in 1973. I don't know about any of you, but I didn't want to be here. I really didn't want to be here. I'd come into the AA meeting, I'd look around, and I'd say, Jesus, if I find these people in a bar, I'd go somewhere else. After I'd been around a while, and read some things in the big book, there was that passage, we are people who are not normally mixed. I'd say, boy, you got that right. Just did not want to be here. I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous all my life. My mother was, they had meetings when I was a child in her home. I never seemed to take. My mom was way ahead of her time. She was married five times by the time I was 11. But she married one of the guys twice. I only had four fathers. I was one of those kids that my mom would say, we're going to call Walter, or we're going to call Bob, Daddy. And we're having a Kelly, you know. I mean, Kelly was just here 15 minutes ago, you know. What's going on? My mom was also periodic, which is real tough on a kid, because then you come home for like months, and the house is clean, and there's food in the refrigerator, and your clothes are clean, and the house is neat. And you bring your little buddies home to play in your room, and there's a taxi cab parked on the lawn, and a bunch of naked people running around inside the house. And you gotta go say, we gotta go play somewhere else. You know? And I love my mom dearly. I didn't understand then. I understood later on. My grandmother took me aside one time when I was having a little problem with my drinking. She says, you know, there's nobody in our family, especially the men, is able to drink. I said, I know that, Grandma, but you understand, Mike, I'm going to be different. I had that conversation with my son. He was about 14 also. I'm Glenn Dykus' father. I used to be somebody. Glenn Dykus used to be my son. You know? But I was just kind of lost as a kid. You know what I mean? My mother was kind of a partying gal. She was trying to work and make a living, and women didn't make very much money in those days, and we lived in some pretty bad neighborhoods and some pretty bad places, and I just sort of ran the streets and raised myself. And I wasn't allowed to play with a lot of the other children. Their parents didn't want their kids to play with me, not because I was necessarily a bad kid, but because I got to stay up till midnight, and they got tired of hearing it from their kids. How come he gets to go out and stay out until midnight, and I have to go to bed at 7:30, you know? Parents didn't want to hear that crap, so they just said, don't play with the kid, you know? And so I kind of became my own best friend. I followed my own direction and did what I damn well pleased and raised myself. Did a wonderful job. You'll hear about it. You know? I was also an entrepreneur when I was young. In those days, they called it Midnight Auto Supply. My specialty was 49 Ford radios. They had a radio in 49 Fords that was over $100, and that was a lot of money in 1949. I mean, you can buy a radio now for $100, and it's considered nothing, but then it was a lot of money. And I'd sell them to Blackie the junkie and junkyard guy in San Fernando for $10. And for $10, you could buy like four, six packs of beer, you know, five, six packs of beer. And that's what I did. That's how I made my side money. One night, I was pulling a radio out of a car. It was about, now I want you to know, when I took a radio out of a car, I unscrewed the bolt, unplugged the wires. All the insurance company had to do was buy another radio and put it back in. I lost five radios. What goes around comes around, I guess. But they have done a minimum of $2,300 worth of damage to my dashboard, getting out a $100 radio, you know. I can't believe it. I come back to my car and the whole dashboard, you know, is gone. One of the side windows is broken. I mean, nobody cares about workmanship anymore. You know? Big quick. But I was taking the radio out of this gal's car, and the radio had just come out, and she jumped in the car to go to the store. Now, what the hell is she going to the store at 1:45? I don't know. But I went off, I grabbed the radio, and I'm running down the street, and she's yelling, "Stop, thief." Now, I got a motorcycle jacket on with beer can openers hanging from all the chains. Engineer boots with solid steel taps on the great running shoes. I'm sparking down the street, and there's a retired policeman and his German shepherd, you know, tackle me. He's got me around the neck, and the German shepherd got me by the pant leg, and he dragged me back to this lady, and I did something I was real good at. Still am, for that matter. I started sniveling. And I said, "You don't understand, my mother's in a wheelchair, and I'm just going to sell this radio and make enough money so we can have some bread and some bologna." And the cop just rolled his eyes up his head and said, "I don't want to deal with this," and he left, you know. And I told the gal I'd put the radio back in. Good thing I'd taken it out right, because I put it back in and got it all working, and she let me go. And I skipped home thinking, boy, Babe Martin was right. There's a sucker born every minute, you know. And the next morning when I got called to the principal's office at school, it was two of the biggest juvenile detectives I ever saw, you know. And when her husband and son came home from Lockheed night shift, my story lost something in the translation. I got a real break. Fred Flack, the director of the Hollywood Boys Club, did a lot of work with troubled children. And I had a key to the Boys Club of Hollywood, so when things weren't going well at home, I could go to the Boys Club, and there was a kitchen, and there was mattresses. You could pull a mattress out and put on the pool table, and I had a home. You know, I had a place where I could always go. And Fred had a thing with the Hollywood Police Department. Anybody got picked up had a club card, he wanted to be called. And so Fred came down and bailed me out and took me home. He told me he wanted to see me in his office the next morning. And he told me to see this Burt Lewis down on Main Street. Burt Lewis was a boxing promoter, and he also owned a barber college. And so at 16 and a half years old, I got an apprentice license and started learning how to be a barber. They thought they'd keep me off the streets. Well, it kept me busy, and I was learning the trade. Hated it. Just hated it. Of course, I hated anything I did then. You know, the only thing I really liked was Midnight Auto Supply. It was easy work. But I started drinking on Skid Row. It was during the Korean War, and a lot of guys were getting discharged, and they're taking their GI Bill, and they were becoming, you know, learning to be barbers. And it seemed like all the ones that I was with were Section 8. You know, that's discharged because of mental incapacity. You know, and they kind of adopted me as their little mascot, and I went down Skid Row and got some phony ID cards, and I started drinking in the bars in Skid Row when I was 16 and a half years old. And I thought I was really hot stuff. You know, I'd wear a sport coat and I don't want to make the court soaker speech that Bill McDonald made a few years back, God forbid. But I was, if you remember, I blanched. I was a sock tucker. But anyhow, I'm losing my place. I'd be in these bars, and I'd see these you know, bums that would be coming in and, you know, buying ponies of wine and drunk and getting thrown out and everything like that. And I just felt so above it, you know, so above them. That, I mean, that could never possibly happen to me. You know, how could that ever possibly happen to me? I mean, I just couldn't possibly believe it. I was 16 and a half years old. I was bulletproof, you know. I mean, it was impossible for anything like that to happen to me, you know. So I thought. So I started getting in trouble with alcohol right from the beginning. You know, I had a tendency to drink like a pig and get drunk. You know, I never really crossed the magic line or the invisible line. I just learned from my parents. You drink to get drunk and be somebody. There's nothing social about it. You know, you just drink to get drunk. Sometimes you get real sociable after you're drunk, but it's a different kind of sociability. We call a sponge in those days. When you go into your favorite bar and they say, your tab's filled up, say, no, I got a sponsor. And it'd be somebody buying you booze. That was a sponsor when I was drinking. So when I came here, they told me I could get a sponsor. I thought, hot damn. But I just muddled along, and life wasn't going well. I was getting in trouble, and I didn't have any money. I'd work in the barbershop at Argyle Barber College, and I'd whatever the guy made that day, I would total it up, and he'd pay me that day, and I'd go out and drink it that night. And I just had, there was just no future. And I was scared and pitiful, and I was just walking down the street one day, and I saw this big sign that says, and there's a big guy in a beautiful uniform with a white hat and a sword, and he's pointing, and he's saying, "The Marines make men." And I thought, you know, that's what I need to do. I need to go in somewhere and get some regimentation and learn to be with men and learn to be a man, and then I won't be so frightened in my body, in my own skin. And I was afraid to go by myself, so I got this buddy of mine to go with me. And we went down and enlisted, and it was towards the end of the Korean War, and they were taking small quotas from all over the country. Well, I took my buddy Sumter first, and he was one of these really good, gregarious guys. He had come to, he was a gymnast, and he'd do somersaults between two-story apartment houses. I mean, he just wanted to laugh at the party. And I saw him after he came back from boot camp, and I still hadn't been called up yet. And I saw him at a party, and he had on these really spiffy green uniform on, you know. But I didn't hardly recognize him. You know, he didn't have any hair, and he had kind of a slumped shoulder. And he saw me, and he walked over to me. He got right in my face. He says, "No, whatever you do, don't join the goddamn Marines." They had slapped every bit of personality right out of him, you know. And my knees got weak, and I kind of blanched. The next day, I went down to the Air Force recruiter, and boy, did I start sniveling, you know. And he says, "Have you been sworn in yet?" And I said, "No." He says, "No problem." He says, "I'll sign you up in the Air Force. You got 6 months to get your stuff in order, and I'll write a letter to the Marine recruiter, and everything will be fine." That was on a Thursday, I believe. Monday morning, I was staying in my underwear at the Moto Day building, you know. Fast 6 months. And that's the first time I realized that the government lies to you. Later, I have to find out a lot, you know. So I went to the Air Force, and I could give you a real litany in the Air Force, you know, the 4 years I spent in the Air Force, but I'll give it to you real quick. I tore the tip off an airplane one night, taxiing it while drunk. Wrecked a weapons carrier one night full of GIs on the way to Midnight Chow, and I was drunk. Hurt one of the guys real bad. I mean, he was just cut to ribbons. We were coming back to Midnight Chow, actually, and he had milk bottles in all his flight jacket pockets, and they all broke. And we took him to the infirmary and said he had fallen in the shower, you know. And then I was accused of assault, attempted rape of a girl I was going with. That was exciting. I got woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and there was 6 constables and 5 APs standing around my bunk, saying, "Get up and put on the same clothes you wore this night tonight." And I was looking around, and I was still stoned. And I said, "I can't find the same sock." And this one constable in a real cold voice says, "I believe this kid's gonna be late to his own funeral." And I was looking at 30 years in the Glasgow prison. And to this day, I have no defense because I don't know what happened. But according to the provost marshal, it was bad enough, but it wasn't quite as bad as it was portrayed. And the family, her father was the ex-Lord Mayor of Kilmarnock, Scotland, when they drew Johnny Walker. And he hated Yanks. Probably had to do something from the guy from the base got another one of his daughters pregnant, and he was really didn't like Americans very well. And they were going to railroad me through, but I got the charges dropped, and I got an Article 15, and I got the Molons and Faint Rocks White for a couple of weeks and lots of stripes. But, you know, the tearing tips off of airplanes and wrecking weapons carriers and driving a weapons carrier through the CO's office and knocking all those plaques on the floor, that makes you a hero. The Air Force is a lot like Alcoholics Anonymous. The worse your story, the more they like you, you know. And but that, you know, a Somalian woman, whether she was my girlfriend or not, was just... I really had a hard time holding my head up for a long time. I mean, I didn't drink for like 3 or 4 days. But, that was good. That was good for me. And I was like Mr. Mistlefix in Little Abner, you know, the little guy with the black cloud and the thunder and lightning. I was either in trouble, or I'd just gotten out of trouble, or was waiting for him to find out what I did. You know, I mean, I was always, just wherever I went, it was just always a... It wasn't impending doom, it was either doom or impending doom. And I remember at the beer bell one time, and all the guys were saying, "Well, I'm an aircraft commander, I'm just this, and I'm that," and everything else. I said, and the guy from the other squadron said, "Well, you know what you are, you're a base gardener." I had so much punishment that I mowed so many lawns and paid so many rocks white that they didn't know I was an aircraft mechanic, they thought I was a base gardener, you know. Well, I was going to make the Air Force my career, but I got promoted 9 times in 4 years, but I got busted 7 times, so... I still got out of PFC or whatever, the Airman First Class, Airman Second Class. And I was a little bit miffed because they didn't give me a good conduct medal. The guy said, just consider yourself lucky you're getting an honorable discharge, kid, you know. And I came back to the States, and now I'm a full-blown alcoholic, you know, and the first thing I do, I get in a allocation with a woman. She said later on that she thought I was somebody she knew, but she waved at me at 3 o'clock in the morning. I was coming home from a bar, and I thought she loved me. So I started chasing her, and she went up a dead end alley, and she backed into my car, and now I was angry. So we had this chase all through Hollywood, and I came around the corner of Kingsley and Melrose, and she was gone. I thought, boy, this woman can really drive. And I drove on, and I turned around and came back, and all those couple of black and whites with the lights going, and she had missed the corner, actually, and she'd taken the back end off of a 49 Ford, go through a barber shop, a cleaner's, and she was in the back of a dress shop, you know. You could see the car way back there among the dresses with the light blinking. And the rock as fine as I am, I stopped and said that I was chasing her. So this is in 57, I was being sued for about $150,000. And I think I had about $5,000 in coverage on my insurance. And I was going to reenlist in the Air Force because I can't guarantee a government salary. You know, that's how bad it was. But I don't know how I got out of that scrape, but I got out of it. And then I thought, you know, what I need to do is get married and settle down. That's what I need to do, because my life just sucks. I was dealing with this gal before I went in service, and she wrote me a Dear John and married a sailor. They had a couple of children, and one of them just had a horrible death of brain cancer, and she was living in Santa Rosa, and I was living down here in Los Angeles, we got a long-range relationship going. Just whip me some water up here. I have one of those long-range relationships where it's all in your head, you know. You fly up there once or twice a month and play, and she flies down here once in a while and we play, and she moved down here, and in 5 days we got married. And I was remembering about halfway to Las Vegas in my roommate's car, and I stopped and borrowed $100 worth of quarters from my dad. And we're going to get married, and I was halfway there, and I realized I didn't want to do it. I really didn't want to do it. But I'd already asked her, you know. So we went to Las Vegas and we got married, had a couple of martinis, and she passed out in the bed, and I went out and gambled. That was our marriage, our first day of marriage. And I can explain that marriage to you real quick. We're going to one of her dad's parties. Her dad was an alcoholic attorney, and he threw great parties. I mean, he spent more money on booze than I earned in a year. I'd get a filter glass, you know, a beer filter glass and fill it full of scotch, and walk around, the guy saying, hey, your beer's flat. You know, I say, yeah, that's all right. But I said, Arliss, for God's sake, let's pretend like we like each other. You know? And that was the state of the... When I go to bed at night, I would be so far away from her that I had to put one hand on the floor to keep from falling out of bed. I mean, I hated this woman. And she was probably on the other side of the bed with her hand on the floor. You know? And she was doing real well. She was taking shock treatments at Camarillo. She was an outpatient. We had a daughter that was handicapped. She was disturbed. She had papers that she was disturbed. The rest of us were really disturbed, but just didn't have papers. And then I had Glenn, who was a terror. And I made this plan for myself. I thought, you know, if I can get this goddamn wife off my back and all these kids and get back to where my life was before I got married, I could have a wonderful life again. Well, I told you what my life was like before I got married. But that's always the good old days. You know, the good old days are always, you remember the best and you forget the bad. So I started saving my money to make my great escape, and she took the broken down Chevy, all $37 out of the checking account, and her clothes, and she split. And she left her kid and our kids. I thought at least she could have done was taking her kid. And there I was, a full-blown alcoholic with an 8-month-old and a 20-month-old and a 5-year-old. And I'll tell you, I thought my life was over. It was. I knew that I couldn't drink the way I'd been drinking and raise the kids. I didn't want to be raised sitting in a car outside of a bar somewhere while my parents were inside having a couple drinks, you know. They'd come out 2 days later, you know. I didn't want to do that. So I took all the hard liquor in the house out to, I had a $3 refrigerator in the garage. I put a big padlock on it, and I threw the key away. And I just thought I would just drink beer and wine. Because beer and wine can't hurt you, right? So then I found, I was in the shop shopping for groceries one day, and I saw that they had this Vine Special Red Mountain for $1.29 a gallon. God, that was good stuff, you know? But I hate to tell you, I have kind of a hangover from a gallon of that stuff. I drank that so much that one of my neighbors gave me a T-shirt that said, Red Mountain, Breakfast of Animals, you know? And I'd wake up in my easy chair, you know, at the, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning with your favorite program on, you know, the Indian Head. Remember the music? You turn the TV off and you got to set the alarm clock so when you pull the plunge out, it doesn't go off. You only got 18 minutes to sleep, you know. You know, I get goosebumps just remembering those days. Jeez. I didn't have a car. I had a Honda 55, which was not street legal. I would put the baby in my lap. The little girl would hang on behind me. I had the diaper bag over my shoulder. I'd go to the babysitter's. We'd get within 2 blocks of babysitter's, and the kid would start screaming. And now I've seen all these videotapes of what babysitters do, you know, and I don't understand why. They're probably putting them in the cage and feeding them dog biscuits, for all I know. So I'd come to pick them up, they'd be hanging on the fence, screaming their heads off, you know. I'd get up on Highway 101. I was up in Newberry Park, and I worked in a barbershop 9 miles away. I couldn't get the motor scooter up on the street, I'd get flattened, so I rode in the dirt all the way down there, you know, with the hubcaps and the wine bottles and the recap. And I'll tell you, my life was over, you know. If you want to see somebody feeling sorry for himself, it was me. And then I started doing something that was really bad news. I would stay in the house, and I would mow the lawn, and I'd behave myself. And I'd just get crazier and crazier and crazier, and I'd drink more and more of that wine. I just had to get out of the house. I say, well, the kids are all right. They're bathing, they're in bed. And there was this little place called the Tally Ho about 5 blocks away in Newberry Park on Wendy Drive. I used to call it the Tally Ho, 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 ho. But I used to sign my checks to Tally Ho, 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 ho. They had all my checks pinned up in the bank because they were always returning them in, you know, illegible handwriting. So they had this check pinned up there, and they'd go up and match the writing, and they'd say, yeah, they'll cash it. That's another story. But I'd stay there like until like 10 o'clock, and I'd run home and I'd check on the kids. I'd go up and have a few beers, play a couple games of pool, and I'd go back and check on the kids. It'd be like midnight, and I'd go, well, the kids would be all right for 2 hours. And I'd wake up in the back seat of this car. I have a car now. A neighbor gave me a 47 DeSoto. It was had no first to reverse. Cardboard windows, you know the kind of car, you know. You'd be very creative when you park a car with no first to reverse, believe me. And I'd wake up in my automobile behind the bar like at 10 o'clock in the morning. Now, I'd missed work, and my heart would stop because the first thing I remember was seeing in the newspaper where the wife, where his mother's at the store and their house burns down with the kids in it. And I'd say this prayer, and I would say it too many times. I'd say, please, God, please, let that house be okay and those kids be all right, and I promise you from the bottom of my heart I will never, ever do this again. And I meant it. And I'd get home, and I'd sneak in the house, you know, and I'd have two kids in dirty diapers. They'd been left. They'd been alone for hours and hours and hours, and I have a splitting headache and a hangover. I don't know how many of you changed a couple of dirty diapers when you got a splitting headache and a hangover. But I mean, I'm telling you, the room is spinning, the bed's spinning, the nursery's spinning, the cots are spinning, the diaper pail is spinning, you know, and your mouth is getting watery. More good remembrances. And I get the kids dressed and everything else, and I go up and give my boss another excuse out of my excuse book. And I did that one time, and only I'd gotten home, and I was getting in bed, and I called the boss that I wasn't coming in. And I don't know, I woke up, and there's a bottle of Old Overholt rye whiskey. Now, God knows where I got it. I've never even seen this stuff in stores. I don't know when the hell I got it. There's about that much left in it, and I was on the end of the bed finishing it off. And the Canal News and Green Sheet was on the ground, and there was in big italics that says, you think you might have a problem with drinking? And you know, until that time, I never, ever looked at the problem of drinking. It wasn't drinking, it was them, it was her, it was the kids, it was my job, it was my breaks. I was a victim. I was just a victim, you know. It wasn't anything I did. I just couldn't help myself. This was my life. It happened to me, and I just had to live and make the best of it. But this morning, for some reason or other, I considered that I might have a problem with drinking. And so I called this number, and it was a real estate guy who came to my house right away, took one look around, got on the phone, called his two daughters. They came down and took care of my house, and he whisked me off to a meeting. And something was to happen to me that I thought was great. I got well quick. I mean, within a week, I'd stopped shaking. Within 2 weeks, I was feeling like I was better than I'd ever felt before. I got a better job. I started putting money in the bank. They were taking bonds out of my salary. I had a new girlfriend. I had a new car. I had a car with, you know, it had a headliner and seat covers. And it was like 6 years old, but it was a nice car, a little Buick Special. And I mean, I was on top of the world. And I was in a meeting one time, you know. Even though I was with people that I wouldn't normally mix with, I decided I was going to a couple meetings a month whether I needed it or not, you know, and saying no to all AA requests. And a nice little lady came up to me, you know, and she was a sweetheart, you know. And she says, "You know, Milton, you don't look like an alcoholic." Now, I'm sure she meant well. But I thought, you know, you're right. And besides that, anybody that can put their life together this well, all by themselves, in 6 months, can't possibly be an alcoholic. And I was gone. And I didn't start drinking right away. I was out with a pretty young girlfriend of mine that had never seen me drink. And she says, "You can have a little wine with your dinner, can't you?" I say, "Hell yeah, I can have a little wine with my dinner. Why not?" So I have a couple glasses of wine with my dinner. There's a little lounge show. We go into the lounge show. I have a couple glasses of scotch. Tall glasses, no ice, lots of water. You know. Come home, take it back to her folks' house. Don't make any obscene passes, you know. Go home, take the babysitter. I've got a babysitter now. I take the babysitter home. Don't make any obscene passes. Take all my clothes off and hang them on hangers. I'm sitting on the end of the bed, and I'll never forget this. The first thought in my mind, what are they talking about, the first drink? Get you drunk. Those people are just thirsty, you know. They don't know what the hell they're talking about. They haven't the slightest clue. And I don't know whether it would be a week or 2 weeks, but somewhere along the way, I wake up in my AC chair watching the Indian Head, listening to that goddamn music, and all the barns were gone, and they were tacking signs on my garage door to quit the property, you know, and I'd be off on a run. Now, when I was drinking, I don't know if Glenn remembers this, but I always had something turned off, either the electricity or the gas or the water. The water was easy. I could run a hose next door to the neighbors and have water. Electricity was tough because you had to use candles, and the gas was really tough because you had to cook in the fireplace. But I remember this one particular time, everything was turned off. In fact, they didn't turn the meter off because I had turned it back on again and chopped their lock off of it. They just dug the meter up and there was a big hole in my front yard where the meter was. And I thought I was doing wonderful, you know. I really did. And you know, my last drunk wasn't my worst drunk. By a long shot. I'd gone with these two guys from the bar. I had a little ski boat, a little fishing boat. I didn't have a car that was powerful enough to pull it. You know, I was back to driving wrecks. You'd think that I would have sold the boat and got a decent car, you know, but not me. So we borrowed this guy's pickup truck and we went up and took my oldest boy, Chip Glenn, and we went up to Lake Casitas. Now, I remember pulling into the bait shop and getting a case of beer and a bottle of scotch for the day. And these guys had a six-pack apiece. And these were guys that I thought if I ever drank like them, I'd quit drinking, you know. I said, "What are you going to do with the 2 6-pack?" "Oh, we're fishing. We don't drink." I said, "Well, that's odd." I don't even remember getting from the bait shop to the launch ramp. It was one of those times when you only drink a couple beers and you just blitzed. And the next thing I remember, I'm laying on the floor of the boat, and these guys are sitting on me trying to get the keys away from me. It's my goddamn boat. It's my goddamn keys. I'll drive if I want to. Well, they had different ideas. The next thing I remember, what got my attention, I fell off the dock onto the boat trailer and kind of hurt my back. And the next thing I remember, I'm waking up in the back of the pickup truck in front of about where on Highway 101 on Camarillo, and it's pouring cats and dogs. And I am just soaking wet, spread eagle in the back of the pickup truck. Glenn and these two guys are in the cab, dry as can be. There's a couple beers rolling around in the cab with me and a little about that much left in the scotch bottle. So I'm drinking the scotch and chasing it with beer and waving at the cars on the freeway, you know. And this one guy brought me off at my house, and I went across the street and got the other kids and took them, put them to bed. And this guy said, "You know," he said, "you didn't know this, Milton, but I was sober in AA for 5 years. And I'm doing all right now." Now, this guy had just fallen off. He was a landscaper, just fallen off a mountain, and he was just skinned up from one to the other when he was drinking. But he was doing all right. But he said to me, he says, if you don't get your ass back to Alcoholics Anonymous, he says, I don't think you can live off a year. And coming from this derelict, you know, this loyal companion, you know, really kind of got my attention. And so I went back. And I didn't do a whole lot different, except I tried to get really involved. And Newbury Park was really easy. I was like 3 months sober, and I got elected to secretary of the biggest meeting. That's because the six people that were elected before me declined, you know. And the secretary of the meeting made the coffee, set up the chairs, did everything, you know. And that was great. There was no meeting in Newbury Park, and I started a meeting in Newbury Park. And that meeting is still going today. It's 21 years old. Nothing I did. I mean, I just got the thing started. But it's kind of nice to look in the directory and see that there's a meeting going that you started. And I got an escape. I raced motorcycles when I went over to Scotland. In fact, I got a 502 on a motorcycle in Scotland. Shows how bright I was. But I had this motorcycle. I turned into a cafe racer, and I was racing around the Insmo Canyon and the mountains, and then I'd go down to the Rock House and drink Pepsi's with the Hells Angels and talk motorcycles and stuff. And that was my escape. I was riding that bike one day, and I was racing through the canyons, and all my problems just wasn't working. Like, those quit working. We're all out there in front of me. You know, my life just sucked, and I didn't know what to do about it, and I was in that place I'd gone in so many times in the 7 years I stripped. And that is, if this is as good as it gets, I'd just soon be drunk. Only in this time, instead of getting a bottle, I went to an AA meeting. And it was a new meeting at the Holiday Inn. And I sit in there, I put the helmet on my lap, you know, and I'm looking around the meeting. First thing I would do in those days was I'd look for her, you know. She wasn't in the meeting. So I was looking to see maybe she was parking her car in the parking lot. And I got to the meeting late. And Clancy was speaking. I don't want to quote him, but I'll paraphrase what I heard. And what I heard was, if you have a problem with alcohol, and you put the plug in the jug, and your family loves you, and you get along with people at work, and everything's wonderful, you don't have to go to these meetings. Well, that's what I heard. And that got my attention. I thought, this guy has got a program where you don't have to go to meetings. I mean, I've been searching for all my life. You know? Maybe you have a little wine at your dinner, you know? And he said, however, if you find that the farther you get away from the last drink, the more untenable your life is, the more suicidal you become, the harder it is for you to get along, then you have a problem they call alcoholism. You have to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you have to get the big book and the 12 and 12 and a sponsor, and you have to do what the winners do. And what that will do for you, it will make you so comfortable within your skin that you won't find it necessary to drink. Now, I have reiterated that hundreds of times. I still get chills when I reiterate that. Because that was the first time in my life that I had got a clue of what it was all about. I heard Johnny Harris one time say that, you know, going to AA meetings and just sitting there in a log and not being part of the meeting, he says, it's just not the way to do it. He says, it's kind of like sitting in a chicken coop expecting to become a chicken, you know. It just doesn't work that way. You have to put in a certain amount of effort. You know, I was told as a kid, like all of us were, and I hated it, you know, you get out of something that you put into it. I spent 38 years trying to figure out something around that rule, and I don't think there is. But I went up to Clancy and asked him if I could talk to him. He said, well, there's a Rams game on, and there was a guy there, Bob Edwards, who was a scout for the Dodgers and an ex-first baseman or something, a baseball player. Clancy was a little more interested in him than he was in me. And I showed up. I don't know what happened to Bob Edwards. God, you know, he's out there somewhere flying his airplane. But I started going to the Pacific Group. And I got real active, you know. I got involved. And that's what I needed. I needed something to do. See, out in Thousand Oaks in Newbury Park, when the meetings were over, everybody went home. You know, they all had families. They went home to their families. I'd sit on the parking lot with the wind blowing through my gut. Just as lonely as hell. I didn't want to go back to those kids. You know, I just didn't want to. And there was nobody to go to have coffee with. So I thought anyhow. They told me that it wasn't that way now, but that's the way I perceived it. And I got real active. And one of my best friends to this day is Bill McDee, you know. And Bill used to kind of sit on me, you know. And we'd go to a movie, and then we'd climb around the bookstores until like 4 a.m, and then we'd talk about the Episcopal Church. And we're nuts, you know. We just sitting on our hands and just making through one day at a time. And I was getting engaged every other week, you know, and Then I got married and had a big marriage wedding, you know. Then I got divorced and nobody showed, you know. They don't all get together for divorces, just for marriages. And that was traumatic because by this time I married three times and I got more children. Well, I was born in 35. What I'd like to say is I would rather speak in front of you people at this group than I would the International Convention. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. I feel now better than I've ever felt in my entire lifetime. Last year I found out that I had Parkinson's disease. And you know, when things like that happen, God gives you something that's a little extra special. And my life is better now than it has ever been. My life is where I thought it would be 5 minutes before I died. You know, I thought, I got it, and that's it. And it's Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the best life that I could ever possibly conceive. And it's because of people like you in rooms like these. Thank you.